At the battles of Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima during World War II, American soldiers were astounded at the ability of their Japanese foes to blend into the various terrains of the Pacific theater. By sewing grass, leaves, twigs, and foliage to their uniforms and helmets, the Japanese would merge with the forest. But the forest would incrementally advance, undetected, until it was too late. Nor could the Americans pinpoint the Japanese guns, for their barrels were concealed in natural rock crevices, or were hidden under removable camouflage covers. The North Vietnamese were equally brilliant at camouflage, reinforcing their skills by the use of tunnels and underground chambers that allowed armed men to pop up seemingly anywhere. Worse, in a different kind of camouflage, they could blend into the civilian population. Preventing your enemies from seeing you until it is too late is a devastating way to control their perceptions. The camouflage strategy can be applied to daily life in two ways. First, it is always good to be able to blend into the social landscape, to avoid calling attention to yourself unless you choose to do so. When you talk and act like everyone else, mimicking their belief systems, when you blend into the crowd, you make it impossible for people to read anything particular in your behavior. Appearances are all that count here. Dress and talk like a businessman, and you must be a businessman. That gives you great room to move and plot without being noticed. Like a grasshopper on a leaf, you cannot be picked from your context. An excellent defense in times of weakness. Second, if you are preparing an attack of some sort and begin by blending into the environment, showing no sign of activity, your attack will seem to come out of nowhere, doubling its power. The hypnotic pattern. According to Machiavelli, human beings naturally tend to think in terms of patterns. They like to see events conforming to their expectations by fitting into a pattern or scheme. For schemes, whatever their actual content, comfort us by suggesting that the chaos of life is predictable. This mental habit offers excellent ground for deception, using a strategy that Machiavelli calls acclimatization. Deliberately creating some pattern to make your enemies believe that your next action will follow true to form. Having lulled them into complacency, you now have room to work against their expectations, break the pattern, and take them by surprise. In the Six-Day War of 1967, the Israelis submitted their Arab enemies to a devastating and lightning-fast defeat. In doing so, they confirmed all their pre-existing military beliefs. The Arabs were undisciplined, their weaponry was outdated, and their strategies were stale. 6 years later, the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat exploited these prejudices in signaling that his army was in disarray and still humbled by its defeat in 1967, and that he was squabbling with his Soviet patrons. When Egypt and Syria attacked Israel on Yom Kippur in 1973, the Israelis were caught almost totally by surprise. Sadat had tricked them into letting down their guard. This tactic can be extended indefinitely. Once people feel you have deceived them, they will expect you to mislead them again, but they usually think you'll try something different next time. No one, they will tell themselves, is so stupid as to repeat the exact same trick on the same person. That, of course, is just when to repeat it, following the principle of always working against your enemy's expectations. Remember the example of Edgar Allan Poe's short story, The Purloined Letter. Hide something in the most obvious place, because that is where no one will look. Planted information. People are much more likely to believe something they see with their own eyes than something they are told. They are more likely to believe something they discover than something pushed at them. If you plant the false information you desire them to have, with third parties, in neutral territory, when they pick up the clues, they have the impression they are the ones discovering the truth. The more you can make them dig for their information, the more deeply they will delude themselves. During World War I, in addition to the infamous standoff on the Western Front, The Germans and the British fought a lesser-known battle for control of East Africa, where both sides had colonies. The man in charge of English intelligence in the area was Colonel Richard Meinertzhagen, and his main rival on the German side was an educated Arab. Meinertzhagen's job included feeding the Germans misinformation, and he tried hard to deceive this Arab, but nothing seemed to work. The two men were equals at the game. Finally, Meinertzhagen sent his opponent a letter. He thanked the Arab for his services as a double agent and for the valuable information he had supplied to the British. He enclosed a large sum of money and entrusted the letter's delivery to his most incompetent agent. Sure enough, the Germans captured this agent en route and found the letter. The agent, under torture, assured them that his mission was genuine, because he believed it was. Meinertzhagen had kept him out of the loop. The agent was not acting, so he was more than believable. The Germans quietly had the Arab shot. No matter how good a liar you are, when you deceive, it is hard to be completely natural. Your tendency is to try so hard to seem natural and sincere that it stands out and can be read. That is why it is so effective to spread your deceptions through people whom you keep ignorant of the truth, people who believe the lie themselves. When working with double agents of this kind, it is always wise to initially feed them some true information. This will establish the credibility of the intelligence they pass along. After that, they will be the perfect conduits for your lies. Shadows within shadows. Deceptive maneuvers are like shadows deliberately cast. The enemy responds to them as if they were solid and real, which in and of itself is a mistake. In a sophisticated, competitive world, however, both sides know the game, and the alert enemy will not necessarily grasp at the shadow you have thrown. So you have to take the art of deception to a level higher, casting shadows within shadows, making it impossible for your enemies to distinguish between fact and fiction. You make everything so ambiguous and uncertain, spread so much fog, that even if you are suspected of deceit, it does not matter. The truth cannot be unraveled from the lies, and all their suspicion gives them is torment. Meanwhile, as they strain to figure out what you are up to, they waste valuable time and resources. During the World War II desert battles in North Africa, the English Lieutenant Dudley Clark ran a campaign to deceive the Germans. One of his tactics was to use props, dummy tanks and artillery, to make it impossible for the Germans to figure out the size and location of the English army. From high-flying reconnaissance aircraft, these dummy weapons would photograph like the real thing. A prop that worked particularly well was the fake airplane made of wood. Clark dotted bogus landing fields filled up with rows of these around the landscape. At one point, a worried officer told him that intelligence had been intercepted, revealing that the Germans had figured out a way to distinguish the fake planes from the real ones. They simply looked for the wooden struts holding up the wings of the dummy planes. Enlarged photos could reveal this. They would now have to stop using the dummies, said the officer. But Clark, one of the great geniuses of modern deception, had a better idea. He decided to put struts under the wings of real aircraft as well as phony ones. With the original deception, the Germans were confused, but could eventually uncover the truth. Now, however, Clark took the game to a higher level. The enemy could not distinguish the real from the fake in general, which was even more disconcerting. If you are trying to mislead your enemies, it is often better to concoct something ambiguous and hard to read, as opposed to an outright deception. That deception can be uncovered, and enemies can turn their discovery to their advantage, especially if you think they are still fooled and act under that belief. You are the one doubly deceived. By creating something that is simply ambiguous, though, by making everything blurry, there is no deception to uncover. They are simply lost in a mist of uncertainty, where truth and falsehood, good and bad, all merge into one, and it is impossible to get one's bearings straight. Reversal. To be caught in a deception is dangerous. If you don't know that your cover is blown, now suddenly your enemies have more information than you do, and you become their tool. If the discovery of your deceit is public, on the other hand, your reputation takes a blow, or worse. The punishments for spying are severe. You must use deception with utmost caution, then, employing the least amount of people as possible, to avoid the inevitable leaks. You should always leave yourself an escape route, a cover story, to protect you should you be exposed. Be careful not to fall in love with the power that deception brings. The use of it must always be subordinate to your overall strategy and kept under control. If you become known as a deceiver, try being straightforward and honest for a change. That will confuse people, because they won't know how to read you. Your honesty will become a higher form of deception. Here are further reflections on misperception strategies. By Winston Churchill. In wartime, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies. From Masters of Deception by David Muir. Dudley Clark was always clear, and a little later it will be shown to have been a pity that others were not equally so, that you can never by deception persuade an enemy of anything not according with his own expectations, which usually are not far removed from his hopes. It is only by using your knowledge of them that you are able to hypnotize him, not just into thinking, but doing what you want. From The Greco-Persian Wars by Peter Green. Themistocles, therefore, had two urgent and simultaneous problems to solve. He must take effective action, not only to block any projected withdrawal by the Peloponnesian contingents, but also to ensure that they fought where and when he planned that they should. And he must somehow tempt Xerxes into making the one move which might lead to a Greek victory, that is, ordering his fleet to attack in the Salamis Channel. The device Themistocles finally adopted, what Plutarch calls his celebrated trick with Sicinus, is one of the most enigmatic episodes in all Greek history. Evidence for it goes back as far as Aeschylus's Persians, performed only 8 years after Salamis. What seems to have happened was this. At some point during the long argument over final strategy, Themistocles, anticipating defeat, slipped away from the conference and sent for his children's tutor, the most faithful of his slaves, an Asiatic Greek named Sicinus. This man was given a carefully prepared message or letter to deliver to Xerxes and sent off across the straits in a small boat, probably just before dawn on the 19th of September. The substance of the message was as follows. Themistocles sent it under his own name as commander of the Athenian contingent. He had, he told Xerxes, changed sides and was now ardently desirous of a Persian victory. No real reason is given for this volte-face, though disgust at the attitude of the Peloponnesian contingents would provide a strong enough motive to carry conviction. The Greek allies were at each other's throats and would offer no serious opposition. On the contrary, you will see the pro-Persians amongst them fighting the rest. Furthermore, they were planning a general withdrawal from Salamis under cover of darkness, to be carried out the following night. If Xerxes struck at once, on the divide-and-rule principle, he could forestall such a move. Attack them and destroy their naval power, while they are still disorganized and before they have joined forces with their land army. The conquests of the Peloponnese would then become a comparatively simple matter. On the other hand, if Xerxes allowed the various Greek contingents to slip through his fingers and disperse homewards, the war might drag on indefinitely, since he would have to deal with each separate city-state in turn. Sicinus's arguments impressed the Persian admirals, and they duly passed them on to the great king himself. Xerxes, we are told, believed the report because it was in itself plausible, and also because it was just what he wanted to hear. There was trouble brewing in Ionia and the empire, and the sooner this Greek expedition was wound up, the better. Themistocles, always a shrewd judge of human nature, knew very well that after so many days of delay and frustration, the great king would grasp at anything which seemed to offer a quick solution to his problem. From The Secrets of D-Day by Gilles Perrault. At the end of the war, Allied intelligence officers discovered in captured files of the German Secret Service the text of 250 messages received from agents and other sources before D-Day. Nearly all mentioned July and the Calais sector. One message alone gave the exact date and place of the invasion. It had come from a French colonel in Algiers. The Allies had discovered this officer was working for the Abwehr, and he was arrested and subsequently turned round. He, too, was used to mislead Berlin. Used and abused. The Germans were so often deceived by him that they ended by treating all his information as valueless. But they kept in contact, for it is always useful to know what the enemy wants you to believe. Allied intelligence, with great boldness and truly remarkable perversity, had the colonel announced that the invasion would take place on the coast of Normandy on the 5th, 6th, or 7th of June. For the Germans, his message was absolute proof that the invasion was to be on any day except the 5th, 6th, or 7th of June, and on any part of the coast except Normandy. From The Ramayana by Valmiki. Now Ravana said to himself, "These are all petty weapons. I should really get down to proper business." And he invoked the one called Maya, a weapon which created illusions and confused the enemy. With proper incantations and worship, he sent off this weapon, and it created an illusion of reviving all the armies and its leaders, Kumbhakarna and Indrajit and the others, and bringing them back to the battlefield. Presently, Rama found all those who he thought were no more coming on with battle cries and surrounding him. Every man in the enemy's army was again up in arms. They seemed to fall on Rama with victorious cries. This was very confusing, and Rama asked Matali, whom he had by now revived, "What is happening now? How are all these coming back? They were dead." Matali explained, "In your original identity, you are the creator of illusions in this universe. Please know that Ravana has created phantoms to confuse you. If you make up your mind, you can dispel them immediately." Matali's explanation was a great help. Rama at once invoked a weapon called Janana, which means wisdom or perception. This was a very rare weapon, and he sent it forth. And all the terrifying armies who seemed to have come on in such a great mass suddenly evaporated into thin air. From The Mind of War by Grant T. Hammond. The real impact of such a strategy is the dissipation of resources, the creation of both self-fulfilling and suicidal prophecies, and the destruction of truth and trust. It maximizes confusion and disorder and destroys the organization's resilience, adaptability, core values, and ability to respond. The key to such a strategy, says Colonel John Boyd, is less deception, the creation of a false order, and more ambiguity, confusion about reality itself. You want to combine fact and fiction to create ambiguity for an adversary. For the combination creates more problems, requires longer to sort out, and calls more into question than merely inserting false information. As an example, he recalled the story of a group of Germans after the Normandy invasion who had stolen some American uniforms and jeeps. They went around the French countryside changing all the road signs to confuse the Allies as they advanced through the area. Soon the Americans figured out that the directions had been reversed, and simply did the opposite of whatever the signs indicated. How much more effective it would have been if the Germans had changed only a portion of the signs, a third to a half, and created even more problems for the Americans. Creating ambiguity about the sign's accuracy and prolonging the time it would take to discover the problem would have been far more effective than changing all the signs in a consistent fashion. From the Book of Joshua. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear or be dismayed. Take all the fighting men with you, and arise. Go up to Ai. See, I have given unto your hand the king of Ai, and his people, his city, and his land. And you shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king. Only its spoil and its cattle you shall take as booty for yourselves. Lay an ambush against the city behind it." So Joshua arose, and all the fighting men, to go up to Ai. And Joshua chose 30,000 mighty men of valor, and sent them forth by night. And he commanded them, "Behold, you shall lie in ambush against the city behind it. Do not go very far from the city, but hold yourselves all in readiness. And I and all the people who are with me will approach the city. And when they come out against us, as before, we shall flee before them, and they will come out after us, till we have drawn them away from the city. For they will say, 'They are fleeing from us as before.' So we will flee from them. Then you shall rise up from the ambush and seize the city, for the Lord your God will give it into your hand. And when you have taken the city, you shall set the city on fire, doing as the Lord has bidden. See, I have commanded you." And when the king of Ai saw this, he and all his people, the men of the city, made haste, and went out early to the descent toward the Arabah to meet Israel in battle. But he did not know that there was an ambush against him behind the city. And Joshua and all Israel made a pretense of being beaten before them, and fled in the direction of the wilderness. So all the people who were in the city were called together to pursue them, and as they pursued Joshua, they were drawn away from the city. There was not a man left in Ai or Bethel who did not go out after Israel. They left the city open and pursued Israel. And the ambush rose quickly out of their place, and they ran and entered the city and took it. And they made haste to set the city on fire. So when the men of Ai looked back, behold, the smoke of the city went up to heaven, and they had no power to flee this way or that, for the people that fled to the wilderness turned back upon the pursuers. And when Joshua and all Israel saw that the ambush had taken the city, and that the smoke of the city went up, then they turned back and smote the men of Ai. From The Secrets of D-Day by Gilles Perrault. The principle is also employed in less tortuous circumstances, but with the same purpose of getting an individual to act naturally in a role because, in fact, he does not know that he is playing a false one. For example, take the design of The Man Who Never Was, operating during World War II, wherein a high-level courier carrying secret papers containing misdirections regarding the Mediterranean invasion was to be washed up on the coast of Spain. After the Major was dropped in Spanish waters, the British attaché in Spain was confidentially told that papers of great importance had been lost, and that he should discreetly determine whether the courier's briefcase had been recovered. The attaché was thus able to act out his part in the fake-out in a very convincing manner, by virtue of the fact that for him it wasn't an act. From Human, All Too Human by Friedrich Nietzsche. Betrayer's Masterpiece. To express to a fellow conspirator the grievous suspicion that one is going to be betrayed by him, and to do so at precisely the moment one is oneself engaged in betrayal, is a masterpiece of malice, because it keeps the other occupied with himself and compels him for a time to behave very openly and unsuspiciously, thus giving the actual betrayer full freedom of action. From The Greek Myths by Robert Graves. Agamemnon had sent Odysseus on a foraging expedition to Thrace, and when he came back empty-handed, Palamedes, son of Nauplius, upbraided him for his sloth and cowardice. It was not my fault, cried Odysseus, that no corn could be found. If Agamemnon had sent you in my stead, you would have had no greater success. Thus challenged, Palamedes set sail at once, and presently reappeared with a shipload of grain. After days of tortuous thought, Odysseus at last hit upon a plan by which he might be revenged on Palamedes, for his honor was wounded. He sent word to Agamemnon, "The gods have warned me in a dream that treachery is afoot. The camp must be moved for a day and a night." When Agamemnon gave immediate orders to have this done, Odysseus secretly buried a sack full of gold at the place where Palamedes' tent had been pitched. He then forced a Phrygian prisoner to write a letter, as if from Priam to Palamedes, which read, "The gold that I have sent is the price you asked for betraying the Greek camp." Having then ordered the prisoner to hand Palamedes this letter, Odysseus had him killed just outside the camp before he could deliver it. Next day, when the army returned to the old site, someone found the prisoner's corpse and took the letter to Agamemnon. Palamedes was court-martialed, and when he hotly denied having received gold from Priam or anyone else, Odysseus suggested that his tent should be searched. The gold was discovered, and the whole army stoned Palamedes to death as a traitor. And lastly, from Family Book on the Art of War, by Yagyu Munenori. Appearance and intention inevitably ensnare people when artfully used, even if people sense that there is an ulterior intention behind the overt appearance. When you set up ploys and opponents fall for them, then you win by letting them act on your ruse. As for those who do not fall for a ploy, when you see they won't fall for the open trap, you have another set. Then, even if opponents haven't fallen for your original ploy, in effect they actually have. Chapter 24. Take the line of least expectation. The ordinary, extraordinary strategy. People expect your behavior to conform to known patterns and conventions. Your task as a strategist is to upset their expectations, surprise them, and chaos and unpredictability, which they try desperately to keep at bay, enter their world, and in the ensuing mental disturbance, their defenses are down and they are vulnerable. First, do something ordinary and conventional to fix their image of you. Then hit them with the extraordinary. The terror is greater for being so sudden. Never rely on an unorthodox strategy that worked before. It is conventional the second time around. Sometimes the ordinary is extraordinary because it is unexpected. Unconventional warfare. Thousands of years ago, military leaders, aware of the incredibly high stakes involved in war, would search high and low for anything that could bring their army an advantage on the battlefield. Some generals, who were particularly clever, would devise novel troop formations or an innovative use of infantry or cavalry. The newness of the tactic would prevent the enemy from anticipating it. Being unexpected, it would create confusion in the enemy. An army that gained the advantage of surprise in this way could often leverage it into victory on the battlefield and perhaps a string of victories. The enemy, however, would work hard to come up with a defense against the new strategy, whatever it was, and would often find one quite fast. So what once brought brilliant success and was the epitome of innovation soon no longer worked, and in fact became conventional. Furthermore, in the process of working out a defense against a novel strategy, the enemy itself would often be forced to innovate. Now it was their turn to introduce something surprising and horribly effective. And so the cycle would go on. War has always been ruthless. Nothing stays unconventional for long. It is either innovate or die. In the 18th century, nothing was more startling than the tactics of the Prussian King Frederick the Great. To top Frederick's success, French military theorists devised radical new ideas that were finally tested on the battlefield by Napoleon. By 1806, Napoleon crushed the Prussians, who were still using the once unconventional tactics of Frederick the Great, now grown stale, at the Battle of Jena-Auerstedt. The Prussians were humiliated by their defeat. Now it was up to them to innovate. They studied in depth Napoleon's success, adapted his best strategies, and took them further, creating the seeds for the formation of the German General Staff. This new Prussian army played a large role in the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo and went on to dominate the military scene for decades. In modern times, the constant challenge to top the enemy with something new and unconventional has taken a turn into dirty warfare. Loosening the codes of honor and morality that in the past limited what a general could do, at least to some extent, modern armies have slowly embraced the idea that anything goes. Guerrilla and terrorist tactics have been known since ancient times. Now they have become not only more common, but more strategic and refined. Propaganda, disinformation, psychological warfare, deception, and political means of waging war have all become active ingredients in any unconventional strategy. A counter-strategy usually develops to deal with the latest in dirty warfare, but it often involves falling to the enemy's level, fighting fire with fire. The dirty enemy adapts by sinking to a dirtier level still, creating a downward spiral. This dynamic is particularly intense in warfare, but it permeates every aspect of human activity. If you are in politics and business, and your opponents or competitors come up with a novel strategy, you must adapt it for your own purposes, or better, top it. Their once new tactic becomes conventional and ultimately useless. Our world is so fiercely competitive that one side will almost always end up resorting to something dirty, something outside earlier codes of accepted behavior. Ignore this spiral out of a sense of morality or pride, and you put yourself at a severe disadvantage. You are called to respond, in all likelihood to fight a little dirty yourself. The spiral dominates not just politics or business, but culture as well, with its desperate search for the shocking and novel to gain attention and win momentary acclaim. Anything goes. The speed of the process has grown exponentially with time. What was unconventional in the arts a few years ago now seems unbearably trite and the height of conformity. What we consider unconventional has changed over the years, but the laws that make unconventionality effective, being based on elemental psychology, are timeless. And these immutable laws are revealed in the history of warfare. Almost 2,500 years ago, the great Chinese strategist Sun Tzu expressed their essence in his discussion of ordinary and extraordinary means. His analysis is as relevant to modern politics and culture as it is to warfare, whether clean or dirty. And once you understand the essence of unconventional warfare, you will be able to use it in your daily life. Unconventional warfare has four main principles, as gleaned from the great practitioners of the art. Work outside the enemy's experience. Principles of war are based on precedent. A kind of canon of strategies and counter-strategies develops over the centuries, and since war is so dangerously chaotic, strategists come to rely on these principles for lack of anything else. They filter what's happening now through what happened in the past. The armies that have shaken the world, though, have always found a way to operate outside the canon, and thus outside the enemy's experience. This ability imposes chaos and disorder on the enemy, which cannot orient itself to novelty and collapses in the process. Your task as a strategist is to know your enemies well, then use your knowledge to contrive a strategy that goes outside their experience. What they might have read or heard about matters less than their personal experience, which dominates their emotional lives and determines their responses. When the Germans invaded France in 1940, the French had second-hand knowledge of their blitzkrieg style of warfare from their invasion of Poland the year before, but had never experienced it personally, and were overwhelmed. Once a strategy is used and is no longer outside your enemy's experience, though, it will not have the same effect if repeated. Unfold the extraordinary out of the ordinary. To Sun Tzu and the ancient Chinese, doing something extraordinary had little effect without a setup of something ordinary. You had to mix the two, to fix your opponent's expectations with some banal, ordinary maneuver, a comfortable pattern that they would then expect you to follow. With the enemy sufficiently mesmerized, you would then hit it with the extraordinary, a show of stunning force from an entirely new angle. Framed by the predictable, the blow would have double the impact. The unconventional maneuver that confused enemies, though, would have become conventional the second or third time around. So the wily general might then go back to the ordinary strategy that he had used earlier to fix their attention and use it for his main attack, for that would be the last thing the enemy would expect. And so the ordinary and the extraordinary are effective only if they play off each other in a constant spiraling manner. This applies to culture as much as to war. To gain attention with some cultural product, you have to create something new, but something with no reference to ordinary life is not in fact unconventional, but merely strange. What is truly shocking and extraordinary unfolds out of the ordinary. The intertwining of the ordinary and extraordinary is the very definition of surrealism. Act crazy like a fox. Despite appearances, a lot of disorder and irrationality lurks beneath the surface of society and individuals. That is why we so desperately strain to maintain order, and why people acting irrationally can be terrifying. They are demonstrating that they have lost the walls we build to keep out the irrational. We cannot predict what they will do next, and we tend to give them a wide berth. It is not worth mixing it up with such sources of chaos. On the other hand, these people can also inspire a kind of awe and respect, for secretly we all desire access to the irrational seas churning inside us. In ancient times, the insane were seen as divinely possessed. A residue of that attitude survives. The greatest generals have all had a touch of divine strategic madness. The secret is to keep this streak under control. Upon occasion, you allow yourself to operate in a way that is deliberately irrational, but less is more. Do this too much, and you may be locked up. You will, in any case, frighten people more by showing an occasional flash of insanity, just enough to keep everyone off balance and wondering what will come next. As an alternative, act somewhat randomly, as if what you did were determined by a roll of the dice. Randomness is thoroughly disturbing to humans. Think of this behavior as a kind of therapy, a chance to indulge occasionally in the irrational as a relief from the oppressive need to always seem normal. Keep the wheels in constant motion. The unconventional is generally the province of the young, who are not comfortable with conventions and take great pleasure in flouting them. The danger is that as we age, we need more comfort and predictability and lose our taste for the unorthodox. This is how Napoleon declined as a strategist. He came to rely more on the size of his army and on its superiority in weapons than on novel strategies and fluid maneuvers. He lost his taste for the spirit of strategy and succumbed to the growing weight of his accumulating years. You must fight the psychological aging process even more than the physical one, for a mind full of stratagems, tricks, and fluid maneuvers will keep you young. Make a point of breaking the habits you have developed, of acting in a way that is contrary to how you have operated in the past. Practice a kind of unconventional warfare on your own mind. Keep the wheels turning and churning the soil so that nothing settles and clumps into the conventional. By Julius Caesar. No one is so brave that he is not disturbed by something unexpected. Historical examples. 1. In 219 BC, Rome decided it had had enough of the Carthaginians, who had been stirring up trouble in Spain, where both city-states had valuable colonies. The Romans declared war on Carthage and prepared to send an army to Spain, where the enemy forces were led by the 28-year-old general Hannibal. Before the Romans could reach Hannibal, though, they received the startling news that he was coming to them. He had already marched east, crossing the most treacherous part of the Alps into northern Italy. Because Rome had never imagined that an enemy would attack from that direction, there were no garrisons in the area, and Hannibal's march south toward Rome was unimpeded. His army was relatively small. Only some 26,000 soldiers had survived the crossing of the Alps. The Romans and their allies could field an army of close to 750,000 men. Their legions were the most disciplined and feared fighters in the world, and they had already defeated Carthage in the First Punic War 20-odd years earlier. But an alien army marching into Italy was a novel surprise, and it stirred the rawest emotions. They had to teach these barbarians a lesson for their brazen invasion. Legions were quickly dispatched to the north to destroy Hannibal. After a few skirmishes, an army under the Roman consul Sempronius Longus prepared to meet the Carthaginians in direct battle near the river Trebia. Sempronius burned with both hatred and ambition. He wanted to crush Hannibal and also to be seen as the savior of Rome. But Hannibal was acting strangely. His light cavalry would cross the river as if to attack the Romans, then retreat back. Were the Carthaginians afraid? Were they ready to make only minor raids and sorties? Finally, Sempronius had had enough and went in pursuit. To make sure he had sufficient forces to defeat the enemy, he brought his entire army across the freezing cold river. It was winter time, all of which took hours and was exhausting. Finally, however, the two armies met just to the west of the river. At first, as Sempronius had expected, his tough, disciplined legions fared well against the Carthaginians. But on one side, the Roman lines were made up of Gallic tribesmen fighting for the Romans, and here, suddenly, the Carthaginians unleashed a group of elephants ridden by archers. The tribesmen had never seen such beasts. They panicked and fell into a chaotic retreat. At the same time, as if out of nowhere, some 2,000 Carthaginians, hidden in dense vegetation near the river, fell on the Romans' rear. The Romans fought bravely to get out of the trap that Hannibal had laid for them, but thousands of them drowned in the frigid waters of the Trebia. The battle was a disaster, and back in Rome, emotions turned from outrage to anxiety. Legions were quickly dispatched to block the most accessible passes in the Apennines, the mountains that run across central Italy, but once again, Hannibal defied expectations. He crossed the Apennines at their most unlikely, most inhospitable point, one that no army had ever passed through before because of the treacherous marshes on the other side. But after 4 days of trudging through soft mud, Hannibal brought the Carthaginians to safe ground. Then, in yet another clever ambush, he defeated a Roman army at Lake Trasimena, in present-day Umbria. Now his path to Rome was clear. In a state of near panic, the Roman Republic resorted to the ancient tradition of appointing a dictator to lead them through the crisis. Their new leader, Fabius Maximus, quickly built up the city's walls and enlarged the Roman army, then watched perplexed as Hannibal bypassed Rome and headed south to Apulia, the most fertile part of Italy, and began to devastate the countryside. Determined first and foremost to protect Rome, Fabius came up with a novel strategy. He would post his legions in mountainous areas where Hannibal's cavalry would be harmless, and he would harass the Carthaginians in a guerrilla-style campaign, denying them supplies and isolating them in their positions so far from home. Avoiding direct battle with their formidable leader at all costs, he would defeat them by exhausting them. But many Romans saw Fabius's strategy as disgraceful and unmanly. Worse, as Hannibal continued to raid the countryside, he hit none of Fabius's many properties, making it seem as if the two were in cahoots. Fabius became more and more unpopular. Having raised Apulia, Hannibal entered a fertile plain in Campania, to Rome's south, terrain that Fabius knew well. Finally deciding he had to act or be thrown out of power, the dictator devised a trap. He stationed Roman armies at all the exit points from the plain, each army close enough to support the other. But Hannibal had entered Campania through the eastern mountain pass of Alafi, and Fabius had noticed that he never left by the same route he entered. Although Fabius kept a sufficiently large Roman garrison at Alafi just in case, he reinforced the other passes in greater numbers. The beast, he thought, was caged. Eventually, Hannibal's supplies would run out, and he would be forced to try to break through. Fabius would wait. In the weeks to come, Hannibal sent his cavalry north, perhaps trying to break out in that direction. He also plundered the richest farms in the area. Fabius saw through his tricks. He was trying to bait the Romans into a battle of his choice. But Fabius was determined to fight on his own terms, and only when the enemy tried to retreat from the trap. Anyway, he knew Hannibal would try to break through to the east, the only direction that afforded him a clean break, into country the Romans did not control. One night the Roman soldiers, guarding the pass at Alafi, saw sights and heard sounds that made them think they were losing their minds. An enormous army, signaled by thousands of torches, seemed to be heading up the pass, covering its slopes, accompanied by loud, bellowing sounds, as if possessed by some evil demon. The army seemed irresistible, far larger than the maximum estimate of Hannibal's strength. Afraid that it would climb above them and surround them, the Romans fled from their garrison, abandoning the pass, too scared even to look behind them. And a few hours later, Hannibal's army came through, escaping from Fabius's cordon. No Roman leader could figure out what Hannibal had conjured up on the slopes that night, and by the following year Fabius was out of power. The consul Terentius Varro burned to avenge the disgrace of Alafi. The Carthaginians were encamped near Cannae, in southeastern Italy, not far from modern Bari. Varro marched to face them there, and as the two armies arrayed themselves in ranks to meet in battle, he could only have felt supremely confident. The terrain was clear, the enemy was in full view, there could be no hidden armies or last-minute tricks, and the Romans outnumbered the Carthaginians by 2-1. The battle began. At first the Romans seemed to have the edge. The center of the Carthaginian line proved surprisingly weak and easily gave ground. The Romans attacked this center with force, hoping to break through and indeed pushing forward, when to their shock and horror they looked behind them and saw the two outer ends of the Carthaginian lines moving around to encircle them. They were trapped in a lethal embrace. It was a slaughter. Cannae would go down in history as Rome's most devastating and humiliating defeat. The war with Hannibal would drag on for years. Carthage never sent him the reinforcements that might have turned the tide, and the much larger and more powerful Roman army was able to recover from its many defeats at his hands. But Hannibal had earned a terrifying reputation. Despite their superior numbers, the Romans became so frightened of Hannibal that they avoided battle with him like the plague. Interpretation. Hannibal must be considered the ancient master of the military art of the unorthodox. In attacking the Romans on their own soil, he never intended to take Rome itself. That would have been impossible. Its walls were high, its people fierce and united in their hatred of him, and his forces were small. Rather, Hannibal's goal was to wreak havoc on the Italian peninsula and to undermine Rome's alliances with neighboring city-states. Weakened at home, Rome would have to leave Carthage alone and put a stop to its imperial expansion. To sow this kind of chaos with the tiny army he had been able to bring over the Alps, Hannibal had to make his every action unexpected. A psychologist before his time, he understood that an enemy that is caught by surprise loses its discipline and sense of security. When chaos strikes those who are particularly rigid and orderly to begin with, such as the people and armies of Rome, it has double the destructive power. And surprise can never be mechanical, repetitive, or routine. That would be a contradiction in terms. Surprise takes constant adaptation, creativity, and a mischievous pleasure in playing the trickster. So Hannibal always took the route that Rome least expected him to take. The road through the Alps, for example, considered impassable to an army and therefore unguarded. Eventually, inevitably, the Romans caught on and began to expect him to take the least obvious route. At that point, it was the obvious that was unexpected, as at Alafi. In battle, Hannibal would fix the enemy's attention on a frontal assault, the ordinary, usual way armies fought at the time, then unleash the extraordinary in the form of elephants or a reserve force hidden to the enemy's rear. In his raids in the Roman countryside, he deliberately protected Fabius's property, creating the impression that the two men were in collusion and ultimately forcing the embarrassed leader to take action, an unorthodox use of politics and extramilitary means in war. At Alafi, Hannibal had bundles of kindling tied to the horns of oxen, then lit them and sent the terrified, bellowing animals up the slopes to the pass at night, creating an indecipherable image to the Roman sentries, literally in the dark, and a terrifying one. At Cannae, where the Romans were by this time expecting the unorthodox, Hannibal disguised his stratagem in broad daylight, lining up his army like any other army of the period. The Roman force was already impelled by the violence of the moment and the desire for revenge. He let them make quick progress through his deliberately weak center, where they became crowded together. Then the swift-moving outer wings of his line closed in and choked them. On and on he went, each one of Hannibal's ingeniously unorthodox maneuvers flowering out of the other in a constant alternation between the uncanny and the banal, the hidden and the obvious. Adapting Hannibal's method to your own daily battles will bring you untold power. Using your knowledge of your enemy's psychology and way of thinking, you must calculate your opening moves to be what they least expect. The line of least expectation is the line of least resistance. People cannot defend themselves against what they cannot foresee. With less resistance in your path, the progress you make will inflate their impression of your power. Hannibal's small army seemed to the Romans much larger than it really was. Once they come to expect some extraordinary maneuver on your part, hit them with the ordinary. Establish a reputation for the unconventional, and you set your opponents on their heels. Knowing to anticipate the unexpected is not the same thing as knowing what the unexpected will be. Before long, your opponents will give way to your reputation alone. 2. In 1962, Sonny Liston became the heavyweight boxing champion of the world by defeating Floyd Patterson. Shortly afterward, he turned up to watch a young hotshot on the scene, Cassius Clay, take on and beat rather decisively the veteran Archie Moore. After the fight, Liston paid a visit to Clay's dressing room. He put his arm around the boy's shoulder. At 20, Clay was 10 years younger than Liston, and told him, "Take care, kid. I'm going to need you, but I'm going to have to beat you like I'm your daddy." Liston was the biggest, baddest fighter in the world, and to those who understood the sport, he seemed invincible. But Liston recognized Clay as a boxer just crazy enough to want to fight him down the road. It was best to instill a touch of fear in him now. The fear did not take. As Liston had guessed he would, Clay soon began to clamor for a fight with the champion and to brag to one and all that he would beat him in 8 rounds. On television and radio shows, he taunted the older boxer. Maybe it was Liston who was afraid to take on Cassius Clay. Liston tried to ignore the upstart. "If they ever make the fight," he said, "I'll be locked up for murder." He considered Clay too pretty, even effeminate, to be a heavyweight champion. Time passed, and Clay's antics provoked a desire for the fight in the public. Most people wanted to see Liston beat the daylights out of Clay and shut him up. Late in 1963, the two men met to sign on for a championship fight in Miami Beach the following February. Afterward, Clay told reporters, "I'm not afraid of Liston. He's an old man. I'll give him talking lessons and boxing lessons. What he needs most is falling down lessons." As the fight grew closer, Clay's rhetoric became still more insulting and shrill. Of the sports writers polled on the upcoming fight, most of them predicted that Clay would not be able to walk on his own after it was over. Some worried that he would be permanently injured. "I guess it's quite hard to tell Clay not to fight this monster now," said the boxer Rocky Marciano, "but I'm sure he'll be more receptive after he's been there with Liston." What worried the experts most of all was Cassius Clay's unusual fighting style. He was not the typical heavyweight bruiser. He would dance in place with his hands down at his side. He rarely put his full body into his punches, instead hitting just from the arms. His head was constantly moving, as if he wanted to keep his pretty face unscathed. He was reluctant to go inside, to brawl and pummel the body, the usual way to wear down a heavyweight. Instead, Clay preferred to dance and shuffle, as if his fights were ballet, not boxing. He was too small to be a heavyweight, lacked the requisite killer instinct. The press critique ran on. At the weigh-in on the morning of the bout, everyone was waiting for Clay's usual pre-fight antics. He exceeded their expectations. When Liston got off the scales, Clay began to shout at him, "Hey, sucker, you're a chump. You've been tricked, chump. You are too ugly. I'm going to whoop you so bad." Clay jumped and screamed, his whole body shaking, his eyes popping, his voice quivering. He seemed possessed. Was he afraid or downright crazy? For Liston, this was quite simply the last straw. He wanted to kill Clay and shut the challenger up for good. As they stood in the ring before the opening bell, Liston tried to stare down Clay as he had stared down others, giving him the evil eye. But unlike other boxers, Clay stared back. Bobbing up and down in place, he repeated, "Now I've got you, chump." The fight began, and Liston charged forward at his prey, throwing a long left jab that missed by a mile. He kept coming, a look of intense anger on his face, but Clay shuffled back from each punch, even taunting Liston at one point by lowering his hands. He seemed able to anticipate Liston's every move, and he returned Liston's stare, even after the round ended and both men were in their corners. His eyes never left his opponent's. The second round was more of the same, except that Liston, instead of looking murderous, began to look frustrated. The pace was far faster than in any of his earlier fights, and Clay's head kept bobbing and orbiting in disturbing patterns. Liston would move in to strike his chin, only to miss, or find Clay hitting Liston's chin instead, with a lightning-quick jab that made him wobble on his feet. At the end of the third round, a flurry of punches came out of nowhere and opened a deep gash under Liston's left eye. Now Clay was the aggressor, and Liston was fighting to survive. In the sixth round, he began taking punches from all angles, opening more wounds and making Liston look weak and sad. When the bell for the seventh round rang, the mighty Liston just sat on his stool and stared. He refused to get up. The fight was over. The boxing world was stunned. Was it a fluke? Or, since Liston had seemed to fight as if under some spell, his punches missing, his movements tired and listless, had he just had an off night? The world would have to wait some 15 months to find out, until the two boxers rematch in Lewiston, Maine, in May 1965. Consumed with a hunger for revenge, Liston trained like a demon for this second fight. In the opening round, he went on the attack, but he seemed wary. He followed Clay, or rather Muhammad Ali, as he was now known, around the ring, trying to reach him with jabs. One of these jabs finally grazed Ali's face as he stepped back, but in a move so fast that few in the audience even saw it, Ali countered with a hard right that sent Liston to the canvas. He lay there for a while, then staggered to his feet, but too late. He had been down for more than 10 seconds, and the referee called the fight. Many in the crowd yelled "fix," claiming that no punch had landed. Liston knew otherwise. It may not have been the most powerful blow, but it caught him completely by surprise before he could tense his muscles and prepare himself. Coming from nowhere, it floored him. Liston would continue to fight for another 5 years, but he was never the same man again. Interpretation. Even as a child, Muhammad Ali got perverse pleasure out of being different. He liked the attention it got him, but most of all, he just liked being himself, odd and independent. When he began to train as a boxer at the age of 12, he was already refusing to fight in the usual way, flouting the rules. A boxer usually keeps his gloves up toward his head and upper body, ready to parry a blow. Ali liked to keep his hands low, apparently inviting attack, but he had discovered early on that he was quicker than other boxers, and the best way to make his speed work for him was to lure the opponent's chin just close enough for Ali to snap a jab at him that would cause a lot more pain for being so close and so quick. As Ali developed, he also made it harder for the other boxer to reach him by working on his legs, even more than on the power of his punch. Instead of retreating the way most fighters did, one foot at a time, Ali kept on his toes, shuffling back and dancing in perpetual motion to his own peculiar rhythm. More than any other boxer, he was a moving target. Unable to land a punch, the other boxer would grow frustrated. And the more frustrated he was, the more he would reach for Ali, opening up his guard and exposing himself to the jab from nowhere that might knock him out. Ali's style ran counter to conventional boxing wisdom in almost every way, yet its unorthodoxy was exactly what made it so difficult to combat. Ali's unconventional tactics in the first Liston fight began well before the bout. His irritating antics and public taunts, a form of dirty warfare, were designed to infuriate the champion, cloud his mind, fill him with a murderous hatred that would make him come close enough for Ali to knock him out. Ali's behavior at the weigh-in, which seemed genuinely insane, was later revealed as pure performance. Its effect was to make Liston unconsciously defensive, unsure of what this man would do in the ring. In the opening round, as in so many of his subsequent fights, Ali lulled Liston by fighting defensively, an ordinary tactic when facing a boxer like Liston. That drew Liston in closer and closer. And now the extraordinary move, the speedy punch out of nowhere, had doubled the force. Unable to reach Ali with his punches, disconcerted by the dancing, the lowering of the hands, the irritating taunting, Liston made mistake after mistake. And Ali feasted on his opponent's mistakes. Understand. As children and young adults, we are taught to conform to certain codes of behavior and ways of doing things. We learn that being different comes with a social price. But there is a greater price to pay for slavishly conforming. We lose the power that comes from our individuality, from a way of doing things that is authentically our own. We fight like everyone else, which makes us predictable and conventional. The way to be truly unorthodox is to imitate no one, to fight and operate according to your own rhythms, adapting strategies to your idiosyncrasies, not the other way around. Refusing to follow common patterns will make it hard for people to guess what you'll do next. You are truly an individual. Your unorthodox approach may infuriate and upset, but emotional people are vulnerable people, over whom you can easily exert power. If your peculiarity is authentic enough, it will bring you attention and respect, the kind the crowd always has for the unconventional and extraordinary. 3. Late in 1862, during the American Civil War, General Ulysses S. Grant made several efforts to take the Confederate fortress at Vicksburg. The fortress was at a critical point in the Mississippi River, the lifeline of the South. If Grant's Union Army took Vicksburg, it would gain control of the river, cutting the South in half. Victory here could be the turning point of the war. Yet by January 1863, the fortress's commander, General James Pemberton, felt confident he had weathered the storm. Grant had tried to take the fort from several angles to the north and had failed. It seemed that he had exhausted all possibilities and would give up the effort. The fortress was located at the top of a 200-foot escarpment on the riverbank, where any boat that tried to pass was exposed to its heavy artillery. To its west lay the river and the cliffs. To the north, where Grant was encamped, it was protected by virtually impassable swamp. Not far east lay the town of Jackson, a railroad hub where supplies and reinforcements could easily be brought in, and Jackson was firmly in southern hands, giving the Confederacy control of the entire corridor, north and south, on the river's eastern bank. Vicksburg seemed secure from all directions, and the failure of Grant's attacks only made Pemberton more comfortable. What more could the northern general do? Besides, he was in political hot water among President Abraham Lincoln's enemies, who saw his Vicksburg campaign as a monumental waste of money and manpower. The newspapers were portraying Grant as an incompetent drunk. The pressure was tremendous for him to give it up and retreat back to Memphis to the north. Grant, however, was a stubborn man. As the winter dragged on, he tried every kind of maneuver, with nothing working, until on the moonless night of April 16th,